It's time for the Performance Difference, featuring leading executives and HR professionals, focusing on recruiting, retaining, and improving employees. Now, here's your host, Laurie Genevieve.
Well, welcome to the Performance Difference podcast. We are very honored today to have a repeat guest, Mr. Bill Treasurer. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good to hear you. Good to hear you as well, Jenny. Laurie, it's good to be with you again.
Yes. And as Bill mentioned, I do have my guest co-host here, Jenny Schmid. Jenny, how are you today?
I'm doing well and looking forward to talking to my old friend and colleague, Bill, one more time.
Great.
His latest accomplishment.
Absolutely. And so for those of you that may not remember, Bill is the Chief Encouragement Officer of Giant Leap Consulting, which is a courage building company. And if you're interested in hearing that, you can go to couragebuilding.com. But the reason why we have Bill on today again is because he has written another book. And Bill, this is like your fourth book now, right?
Yep, this is my fourth book, although I was the senior editor of a fifth book, but that was a compilation book. So it's four and counting.
Great. And I tell you, what made me really want to have you on as a guest again is because the title of this book is A Leadership Kick in the Ass, and How to Learn from Rough Landings, Blunders, and Missteps. So my first question to you is, what compelled you to write this book?
Well, you know, the book itself, originally it was going to be called Leadership is Freaking Hard. And that was the original title of the book, the working title. And then it morphed into A Leadership Slap in the Face. And then in working with my publisher, we thought, you know, what really this book is about are those moments that are so leveling as a leader, so unexpected, so destabilizing, that they cause you to question everything about yourself, that they feel like a swift kick in the ass. And as we said that a couple of times as we were talking, and it was like, you know, why don't we just call it that? Because that's really what the book is about. We were worried a little bit about the three-letter swear word, and but a couple of things, you know. First, for the last bunch of years, I've been working with Chicago-based unionized construction companies, and believe me, ass is the smallest word in the room, right? Like, there's way worse language than that. And then I also vetted the word with my mom, who happens to be 80 years old, and she said, you know, let's face it, Billy, ass isn't much of a swear word anymore. So we decided, you know, let's just go with that word, because the truth of the word, sometimes that our most profound, enduring, positive leadership lessons come from those emotional ass kicks that level us and humble us. And mm-hmm. The good thing about when you get humbled is you get humble. And humble is, humility is really important to leadership.
Exactly. Can you give maybe an example of, you know, you've worked with different clients. What's an example of one of these proverbial kicks for a leader?
A lot of times, you know, first of all, they're brought on by the leader's behavior themselves oftentimes. So a leader may feel disrespected or some injustice has been done to them, or they're not getting the support from people above them, and it's always everybody else's fault that the leader is suffering this thing. But when the leader gets real about it, they'll find that a lot of times it's the consequence of their own obnoxious behavior that results in a butt kick. And the most common one, I would say, is feedback that runs counter to your expectations. So, for example, in a performance review, you know, a lot of people have been through this experience where you get feedback that you were not expecting, that you thought you were the cat's meow in terms of leadership. You assumed that you were doing way better than you were. And heck, you might even have the results to prove that you're a good leader. But then you get feedback that your people think you're obnoxious, that your people aren't following you and aren't loyal to you, that people are looking for ways to not work with you. Maybe a couple of people have left that did work with you. Maybe your boss gave you the feedback and it wasn't a 360. It was in a performance review. So you get some feedback that startles you so much that it causes you to question everything about who you were as a leader. Gandhi once said that the truth only hurts if it should. And if you get that kind of stinging feedback, that now you've really lost confidence in who you are as a leader, it's a great moment. It's where the learning can now start to take place if you have an open mind and are ready to learn. And now you can get to choose the leader that you actually want to be versus the leader that you are.
Right. I think, and you even talk about that in your book, you have one or two choices. You can either embrace it and become, like you said, the leader you are, or you could become arrogant and be like, no, it's them, not me, you know, type thing.
Yeah, I think that pretty much every, there's an inevitability to this. If you are a leader, you know, and my sense is that folks listening to the podcast today, that they're involved in this, you know, because they're interested in the idea of leadership. If you are a leader, it is inevitable that you are going to have an ass-kicking moment at some point in time. Any leader worth their salt, this is how you earn your stripes, has gone through this kind of event. And the Clint Hurdle, who wrote the foreword to the book, is the coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he put it really well. He said, Bill, there's two kinds of leaders. Those who have been humbled. Those who have been humbled. And those who are about to be. So if you have not yet been humbled, you will be. It's just a matter of time. Right?
Yeah. That's
so
right.
And then the question becomes, what do you do with it? And so my sense is that any career, and they can happen at different stages in your career, but any career is likely to suffer a humiliating ass kick at some moment in time. The good news is that this can become the moment that transports your leadership and ultimately strengthens it if you can get humble enough and get past your own ego so you can start to learn the lessons from it.
Right. So in your book, you talk about the four stages of a kick. So can you walk us through that so that, you know, what do we, you know, so we know, all right, this is the kick he was talking about, and what do I do?
The first stage is comfortable oblivion. You don't even know, right? Like, you're oblivious to yourself. You make false assumptions about yourself in terms of how good of a leader that you are. You're blithely going along through your leadership life, whistling and assuming that you're a way better leader than you actually are. So comfortable oblivion is the first stage. Mm-hmm. The second stage is what I call a startling sting. A startling sting. Something slaps you upside the head. Maybe it's tough feedback. Maybe a few people have quit under your leadership. Maybe you've suffered your first big consequential failure that cost the company or organization money. Mm-hmm. It can manifest itself in many different ways, but it startles you, it stings you, and you're embarrassed. And yes. I think that's key to the startling sting, is this sense of embarrassment and humiliation. And now that brings you to stage three, which I call a change choice. Now you got a choice. Are you going to double down on your conviction that you were right and everything and everyone around you was wrong? Mm-hmm. They're the ones who got it wrong, which I call rejection. So you're rejecting the lesson. You're ultimately, if the change choice, if you choose that path, you're rejecting it. On the other hand, at the change choice, you may get to a point of capitulation and surrender and get past your ego and say, you know what? I screwed up. Oh my gosh, I'm embarrassed. It was my mistake. And that, so you have a change choice, accept or reject. And based on that change choice that you make in that third stage, you move to the fourth stage, which is either your result of humility. So you come out through acceptance, you come out to humility and say, okay, I'm willing to learn. How can I get better? What was my contribution to this? How did I cause this? What do I need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again? Which gives you humility. Or if you choose to reject the lesson and double down on your conviction that you were right, you're likely to become arrogant. And over time, that same lesson is going to bubble up again and again and again until you confront it. There's an old saying, if you don't learn the lesson, you have to repeat the class. Mm-hmm. So the four stages are comfortable oblivion, startling sting, the change choice, and then the result, which is either humility or arrogance.
And so, you know, talking about the humility or the arrogance, do you think there's certain inbred traits in people to help them with it? You know, like, I guess maybe for the arrogant person, they have to be kicked enough times to say, okay, maybe it's not me. I mean, maybe it's not them. Maybe it is me. I have to change something.
I think that this is the beauty of the ass kick, right? Is that it's this humbling event that finally is going to get through to a person that can startle them enough that that maybe it becomes a moment where humility can usher in. So I use this term in the book called transformative humiliation, and I almost called the book that, but I got some feedback that that people they were like. They didn't like the word humiliation, right? And it does sound, it's a humiliating word. But the fact is that the word humility is derived from the word. So you can't really get to humility without the experience of humiliation. So there's actually good stuff from those humiliating events that when you're embarrassed, you don't want to be embarrassed again. It's like riding a bicycle. When you fall off a bike and scrape your knees, it hurts. It's painful. But pain can be instructive because when you get back on that bike to try it again, you pedal harder and faster. Same thing with this transformative, humiliating event. When you're embarrassed, you want to not have to be embarrassed again. So you start to be willing and open to learn from, to acquire humility, right? It's hard because I think that people either sort themselves into either being self-absorbed, which in the book I call a pig head, or some people are self-neglectful, and I call that a weakling. And if you're in either one of those two conditions, it's not good. And for the pig-headed leader, this idea, it takes a serious big-time butt kick for them to be willing to get humble. But like as I say, this idea of the benefit of a humbling event, when you get humbled, you have the potential to now become humble. And humility is so crucial to effective leadership because people want to follow a leader who has backbone, is confident, but hasn't lost sight of their roots, knows who they are, is grounded, doesn't think that they're better than other people. So humility is really important.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the pigling the, and the I'm sorry, the pig heads and weaklings. And so talk a little bit more about those, like how could you identify it, be like, okay, I'm a pig head.
Good. Yeah. So, well, you know, a lot of leadership books talk about different leadership types and the directive leadership and the supportive leader. And I started thinking about, well, let's talk a little bit about types of dysfunctional leaders. And the leaders that I've worked with, and I've worked with a lot of them over 25 years. I mean, it's what I do, right? Like, I don't fancy myself a leadership expert because that word, you know, for me, it just brings up blockage because, you know, I just think it's an arrogant word to think I'm going to rub, you know, pound my chest and say that I'm an expert. You know, I think I'm a leadership plumber. That's the truth, right? Like, I roll up my sleeves and I work with leaders every day. It's what I do. It's my job is I go to the job site, I roll up my sleeves, and I help remove whatever hairballs that those leaders are facing. And the job ain't always pretty, but I'm a leadership plumber and I'm proud
I love that.
of
Yeah, that's pretty.
it. You know, so when I work with these leaders, what I found is that there's two conditions, the two dysfunctional types of leaders, the two leaders you don't want to be, and they're sort of at diametric ends of a spectrum. On the one hand, it's the self-absorbed leader who talks about, you know, my way or the highway, do it because I said to do it, super over-directive, overconfident to the point of self-absorption. And I call this leader a pig head. A pig head, right? It's got to be all about them. I remember one time being part of a conference where one of the speakers on the docket leaned over to me and said, "Hey, this other guy who's speaking today, when he walks in the room, watch him. His ego comes in the room 30 minutes before he does."
Oh my gosh.
Sure enough, that guy came in the room, started bragging about how he manhandles his board of directors and that they do what he tells them to do.
Oh
He's
my
t
God.
talked about how he had more guts than his predecessor to take the risks that the b business finally needed to have being taken. He bragged about how he hired his own family members and children because he knew they had the right DNA.
Oh my gosh, this just makes me cringe.
And then if you think that, you know, if that weren't enough, Laurie, he ended up giving everybody a copy of his favorite book of quotations. And the only person quoted in the book was himself.
No.
I'm not kidding you.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is a pig head. This is
Now we know just what you mean.
Yeah. Right. Now, maybe most people have worked for a pig head at some point in their career. But this guy was an embellished example of, you know, it was a real guy. And those things really happened. But he's like the embellished example of a pig head. Turned out a couple of years later, when his company went bankrupt, the company that he had become the CEO of, you know, he was also an absent leader. He was oftentimes on his yacht. And not being at the job site. You know, there was a lot of things wrong with his leadership. He's still out there, by the way. I hope he's not listening to this podcast. Or maybe I hope he is. But that's a pig-headed leader. On the other end of the spectrum is what I call a weakling. And the weakling, the challenge for them is not self-absorption. It's self-neglect. They don't stand up for themselves. They don't have backbone. They'll be in a meeting and they'll be really wanting to see what everybody else is saying. And then they choose words that sort of mimic what everybody else has said. So they don't have any opinions of their own. They second guess themselves. They don't have confidence in their own experience. An example of this is I did work with a leader who had a person. I'll give you a different example. A leader that was being put in charge of something, and he was really good at leading his direct reports. Like, he could be forceful and could be tough when he needed to and such. The challenge was he was terrible about managing the people above him. And he became in charge of a committee that on that committee sat people that all outranked him. And he would never speak up in the meetings, even though it was his meeting to run and it was his to assert himself and to have an opinion about, because those meetings pertained to his piece of the business. And finally, the CEO had to take him aside, and during a performance review, of which I was a part, it was the three of us in the room, he said, you know, he gave him some feedback, and the guy ended up saying, but wait a minute, I'm a good soldier. I do what you tell me to do. And he goes, the CEO said, that's exactly the problem. Mm-hmm. I don't need you to be a good soldier. I need you to be a general. And when you're in that room, I need you to finally stop biting your tongue and take some risks out in front of the group. You got to be able to state your opinion, and it's going to withstand some scrutiny, and people are going to second guess you, and you got to have some backbone to take that. So that ultimately he was saying, stop being a weakling because you're losing credibility among that group of people. I actually think that weakling leadership behavior is more common behavior. The challenge is I also think it's deadly to a career, because at least the pig head gets results. They leave all sorts of wreckage in the way when they get the results, but they get results. But the weakling leader ultimately doesn't get results, and they become irrelevant, and they'll be marginalized in the organization. So you don't want to be either one of those leaders. And the consequence comes if you are either one of those leaders, eventually there's going to be a reverberation in the form of feedback or some other manifestation that will let you know, and you'll get humiliated. In the case of the weak leader, he got that feedback from the CEO, so it stung. In the case of that CEO, that company went bankrupt. So there's always a consequence for obnoxious or weak behavior.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think your book does a good job of describing the consequences for the people that report to the weaklings. And really calls out this leadership deficiency in a way that I haven't seen before. But it's not easy to get results when you have a weakling leader. Wouldn't you agree, Bill?
Yeah, it's not easy to get results when you've got a weakling leader. For one, you're not supported yourself. If you got a weakling leader, they're not going to back you up. And that leader, when the team is together, might say, okay, yeah, that sounds like the good direction. And then they get into a room full of other people who outrank them, and they quickly fold. And so you never really can trust that leader has anybody's back and that they're not going to change the decision and be wishy-washy and fickle. So it's hard to have a sense of predictability when you've got a leader who's weak like that. At least with the pig head, you know they're always going to be a pig head. With the weakling, they might in front of you say things that have backbone, and then they go into the next room with people that are outrank them, and they quickly fold. And so it's hard to be successful with either one of those leaders, but it's really hard to be successful with a weakling leader.
Bill, this reminds me of a theme that I felt really ran through the book, and that's the theme of balance. And we've touched on two elements of balance that I saw in the book, one being the balance between your boss and your direct reports when you are the leader, and the other one being the sweet spot between the confidence and the humility and all those things that we're talking about. That really sounds like kind of a tightrope to watch and something that maybe requires some courage to get right.
Right. I think that it does take, you know, the sweet spot is this, you know, the place where you want to be. You want to be able to respect others equally as much as you respect yourself, right? It's like the golden rule, do unto others as they would have done unto you. It's the same thing. It's like if you're somebody who doesn't respect others and only respects yourself and is an obnoxious pighead, you're out of balance. If you're somebody who respects others entirely and doesn't respect yourself, you're out of balance. The balance place is to have self-respect and respect for others in equal measures, and you become confidently humble. So you've got confidence and humility in the right balance, and it's right-sized for who you are as a person. Not easy to get. I think we probably all struggle with it on any given day. And by the way, one thing I don't say in the book, but I believe to be true, is I think that leadership is it's an approximation, right? Like, I don't think any one of us is a perfect leader, nor have we met a perfect leader. I think that leaders do the best they can. And sometimes it's three steps forward and one step back. And there's going to be a couple of days where you might be three steps backwards and one step forward. And I think we do the best we can and try to struggle with this balance between getting confidence right and getting humility right. But we shouldn't give up on the struggle to constantly get better at that balance.
Well, I think you bring up a good, I mean, we all make mistakes, you know, whether what role we're in. And as a leader, like you said, it just don't beat yourself up, but just learn from it and have the humility in order to learn from it and hopefully not make the same mistake again.
Yeah, mistakes are so powerful. I mean, if you just read the biography of any leader that you admire, and there's bound to be some pivotal moment in there in the narrative of the story where everything goes off kilter, where everything becomes destabilized, where there is a down moment in the story where the leader now questions everything that they've done and who they are. And oftentimes it's a result of some blunder of their own, some misstep, some mistake that they made. And we tend to not talk about those moments, but those moments to me are, that's where the juice is in the learning. That's becomes the pivotal part of the narrative. I mean, it's, you go to the movies, same thing, right? Yeah. If you just saw a movie and it was like on a high plane the entire time, it would be boring. Mm-hmm. And if it was on a low plane the whole time, it would be depressing. You know, so you kind of need these moments that are searing in their emotional, I would call it a transformational, humiliating event. And somebody pointed out recently in an interview that I had that's T-H-E, a transformational, humiliating event. It's like the event. This is the big.
Oh, nice.
This is the pivotal moment that you've got to make a decision about who you're going to be as a leader going forward. I tell the story in the preface of the book of my own experience where I was leading, you know, I know the two of you know, and yes, your listeners may not, but I used to be a member of the U.S. high diving team. And I would dive from 100-foot platforms into little pools, traveling all around the country. And this was it was fun. I loved doing it. I did it for 7 years. But it was also high-stakes stuff. And if we didn't team together well, any one of our divers on any given day could have died. And I was put in charge of the troop of athletes at a young age. I was about 24. And I was obnoxious as a leader. I didn't know how to be a leader. All I knew was my predecessors and how they led. And ultimately, I was like channeling my dad, you know. And so I was a real angry, uptight, and really overly demanding kind of leader because I was afraid and I didn't want people to know that. And finally, one of the divers one day, who happened to be older than me, and I think that mattered to the story, came up to me after the show, after I had just lit into the team for a poor performance. And he said, "Hey, Treasurer, don't talk to us like that. You talk to us like that again and I'll walk. I don't need the job that badly to be treated that badly by you."
Yeah, and that was your kick.
That was my kick. That was my first leadership ass-kicking moment. And now, Lori, I'll tell you, I look back on that moment. I was embarrassed, right? I told you what Gandhi said, the truth only hurts if it should. Yes. And it stung. It stung. I was really embarrassed. And first I tried to defend it. And at first I tried, you know, told him he was wrong. And it was none of his business, blah, blah, blah. And once I got past the ego part of it, and that's essential. You got to look, it's going to bruise your ego. You got to go lick your wounds and go deal with your sensitive ego. But once you get past that ego part of it and the learning can come in, you know, I started reading books on leadership. I read The 1 Minute Manager. I read Up the Organization. And I came across this term organizational development. I said, hey, maybe I could go to graduate school. And I went to graduate school. I did my thesis on leadership and I got into a consulting job and et cetera, et cetera. 25 years later, I'm thankful that Steve Willard told me that I was a sucky leader because I was. And that butt kick that he gave me my career, right? It's,
yes.
That was a transformational, humiliating event. It was the event. And so when you're in it, don't shy away from it. Embrace it and say, what can I learn from this? And how's it going to make me better? Because what kind of leader does your people deserve you to be? And it'll force you forward to be better.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, you read enough, you know, business articles and successful people, they all have that moment, the moment that, you know, transforms them. So absolutely. You know, you do talk about in the book about, you know, in order to be a good leader, and we touched on it briefly, is having self-respect and also living to your values. Talk a little bit about how that really plays a part in the groundwork of being a good leader.
Yeah. So I mentioned a while ago that, I think that seasoning does matter to leadership. I think that age, frankly, matters a little bit to it. You know, I think I was really ripe, right? I was 24 when I got that tough feedback and I was a green bean. I didn't know anything about leadership at that point. I think it takes some seasoning over time. And what's kind of beautiful about this this ass-kick moment, this kick-ass moment, is that if you do get the lessons and the humility does come in, you now have made what I call a holy shift. And the holy shift moment is that you stop thinking about yourself and you start thinking about your people. You stop with the sharp elbows of ambition, and you start thinking about how can I serve the people that are working with me, not what do I need to tell them to do to get done for me. You start to recognize that your own success as a leader is contingent upon the success that you help others get through their contributions and gifts. So a leader is only successful to the extent that they help other people become successful. Leaders need followers more than followers need leaders. And the beauty of this butt kick moment is that it can cause this holy shift where you start becoming respectful of others and respectful of yourself. And I think that that self-respect matters. Like, you know, do you eat well? Do you exercise? Do you go to church? Do you have a set of values that you embody and abide by? Do you have integrity? Because that's where it starts. You know, if you want to be a good leader, start by being a good person. Start by being a good person. And I think it's easier to be a good person once you've suffered through some butt kick moments and realize that you are not the end all be all, that the first law of leadership is it's not about you.
Yes.
It's about them. So those are what I'd say about that.
And Bill, I think you've really humanized leadership because I couldn't help but notice as I was reading the book and as I'm hearing you speak, a lot of the growth that you're talking about is the same kind of growth that I encourage with my life coaching clientele, you know, and you're doing it with leaders. There's just a ton of overlap. And all the things you mentioned, humility and values and integrity, in the book you say they all come together to the point of goodness.
Yeah, I call it leading at the point of goodness. And Ginny, you know, it's been my experience that a lot of leaders, I think it's really common, maybe more common than not, for leaders to be what I would call a conditional leader. that they're like, Bill, I know, look, I'm going to be a good leader, but now's not a good time, okay? We got to meet the quarterly results, and I can't be a good leader right now, but I'm going to be. Or, I'm going to be a good leader, but right now I inherited this team, and some of these people really suck, and I got to get them off the team. So I'm going to be a good leader, but once I reconfigure the team, but not now. You know, we've got these excuses for why we're going to be the leader that we're meant to be, but just not now because I'm under too much stress, or I've got too much going on, or I've got – and that is what I would call a conditional leader. I'm conditioning my good leadership on these other things that have to happen first, which will allow me to then be a good leader. I think that leading at the point of goodness starts with the commitment that I'm going to be an unconditionally good leader. I'm going to be a good leader despite the fact that it's stressful, despite the fact that we've got too much going on in our project, despite the fact that I'm under-resourced, despite the fact that my boss doesn't support me enough. I'm going to be a leader in all of my interactions at the point of goodness, because I'm going to operate from my own set of values and integrity and not assume that I'm better than somebody else because I'm in a leadership position, but that I have a responsibility to serve other people in a way that betters their lives and the lives of the organization and betters the organization. So it's leading with unconditional goodness. Again, I want to underscore and emphasize and reemphasize, I'm not saying I am this. I'm saying on any day of a week, maybe if I can get that right one or maybe 2 days a week, that's pretty good. Because leadership, again, is an approximation. But that should be our goal, is to be an unconditionally good leader, not a conditional leader.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually one of the things also, too, that I like in your book. You know, we try to be good. You know, we live by our values. But sometimes, as a leader, there are people as part of your team or maybe part of another department that try those, you know, your values. Mm-hmm. And what do you say to those when you have those days that it's like, it is the other person, it's not you?
Well, I know that the both of you do some executive coaching and life coaching and such. And I certainly hear it in my executive coaching practice. A lot of times the coaching conversation comes down to some frustration that the coachee is having with somebody else in their life. And a lot of times when it's leaders, it's some direct report or an obnoxious boss or a crazy customer. And what I would say, and where I always usually try to get the coachee to, is for them to say, okay, yes, it's true, it's very stressful, and I realize this person's frustrating. And then my question to them becomes, in what way is this person actually your greatest opportunity right now for leadership development? Mm. Right? Instead of them thinking of this person as a problem that needs to be solved, think of this person as their own greatest opportunity for leadership development. And suddenly the stresses and frustrations are put into a different perspective, the perspective of maybe I can actually learn something that'll make me a stronger leadership through my interactions with this person. Maybe if I try to modify my behavior a little bit and the way I approach this person or what I say to this person, maybe I'll get different results. You know, we've all heard this old saying. My mom used to say it. I must have told you 1,000 times. If you've told somebody something 1,000 times and they haven't changed their behavior, maybe it's not them. Right? Maybe it's your approach to them. Notwithstanding, Lori, that there are going to be situations that are almost irredeemable, that really it isn't about you as a leader. And sometimes it is going to be about other people. I think that far more often it's the other case. But in the cases where it is some flaw or defect or, character challenge in the person that you're dealing with, when you're in the leadership role and you've got somebody that, you know, client, customer, direct report that is problematic, and you've tried and exhausted all the things you have, and maybe it is about them, and occasionally it is, then I think then you have to choose to be the leader that they deserve. And mm-hmm. Is the leader that they deserve. I guess what I would say is two sillies don't make a sense. So don't the trick is, again, this is where it challenges conditional leadership. Will you drop into their behavior? In other words, do you take the low road because they're taking the low road, or you do sort of the Michelle Obama thing, when they go low,
that's
we go high.
I was just thinking, yep.
Right. Do you take the high road? That, I try to remove politics from this, but I do believe there's something to that statement, that just because people have gone low doesn't become the excuse for you to be able to adopt behaviors that are at their level. You try to lift them up to a higher standard.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I, years ago when I was in corporate, I had someone like that as part of my team. And they did take the low road, and they did challenge me quite a bit, but was able to work through it and help bring them to that high road. But yeah, because if you go down with them, you know, to that low road, you're just putting the whole team down on by doing that.
Oh yeah, and you'll lose the respect. You may even win the battle in that moment with that person, but you'll lose the respect of people around you, and more importantly, you'll lose self-respect.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what it goes back to for me. One of the tenets that I got out of the book was the things that make you successful as a leader are the same things that make you successful in life, and really the backbone of that is knowing your values and making a commitment to have integrity to those values. And we all don't hit it out of the park every time we're faced, you know, with a crossroads and a decision to make. But it's very similar. And, you know, if you get one down, you'll probably get the other one down, too.
Yeah, I think so. I think that values and principles and embodying them and, you know, really that's so crucial, because it connects so much to integrity. And the fact that we're human, and sometimes we fall away from those values, and sometimes we have to reconnect with them, and we get lessons that refresh them and remind us of them, and then we have to recommit to them, but we don't stop. And I'm not suggesting that anybody on the phone or on the podcast needs to be a goody two shoes or, you know, some self-righteous piety. I'm not into that, because that's arrogant in a different direction. Mm-hmm. But I do believe in authenticity and the constant striving to do better, and the willingness when you do wrong to admit it to yourself. And to ask for forgiveness to whoever you harmed, you know, make amends afterwards. And people really appreciate that. They like a leader who's humble enough to not assume that they're, you know, leaders get a lot of cues. They get a lot of messages that suggest that they're better than other people. That we pay them more. We give them a bigger parking space. We give them more floor space in the office. We defer to their judgment. We don't question them in the meeting. Suddenly, we start to send them, you know, symbolic cues that say, "Hey, leader, you're special." And then they start to believe it, right? And it's easy to get hypnotized and deluded by the intoxication that leadership can sometimes come with. And I think it's really important for a leader to stay grounded, and that hence that idea of humility, in things like values and principles, regardless of the fact that you might have a bigger expense account now that allows you to eat dessert after every single meal. You've got to be able to not lose sight of where you came from and have a good root system. And those roots are really about values and being able to anchor to them.
I bet you do a lot of that with your work with people. Is start with that. You know, what are your values? Is that true?
A lot of times, especially in coaching, and a lot of times if they don't know them, I think that they know them, but they may have to suss them out a bit, and they'll come out in the stories. I'll ask them about, you know, leaders that they admire, leaders that influenced them from the time that they were a kid on upwards. And sometimes the values start to emerge in the stories. A time when they were the leader that they always had hoped they would be, a time where they felt they did a good job of leading, a time when they regretted, you know, I think stories start to surface what values are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What one of the things I love about your book, one, you have great stories to illustrate points. You also have some exercises and tips. And I encourage everyone to go out and get this book. It truly is a phenomenal book and can change the way you are as a leader and make you more successful. But for our listeners right now, what are some initial steps you would tell them to start off with to help them deal through what the kicks they get as a leader?
Sure. The first one is define your future self. Define the leader you want to be. Because that will set up a gap between the leader that you are today and the leader that you are aspiring to be. And it's in that gap that now we can get to work to close the gap and start to identify the actions that will help you become the future leader that you're trying to be. And it might also point to the direction of what kind of mentors do you need in order to become that future self? What kind of work experiences do you need? What kind of leadership experiences that would help you actualize the vision of who you want to be as a leader? So that'd be tip number one. One tip I think is good, you know, because it gets to the ego component. Because ego is the thing, right? Like ego can get in our way. Sometimes it's like a balloon, right? Like if it's just that little, if it's that little balloon and there's nothing in it and there's no air in it, we got to blow up the balloon. But if there's too much air in that balloon, it's going to pop. Right? So I think it's important to have what I would call a chief ego deflator. A chief ego deflator, a CED. And I'll give you a story to illustrate this. You know, I'm lucky. I get to, you know, I'm talking to you all today. I've got another interview in the afternoon. I just came from a presentation to leaders in the morning. I have a nice life. I like the life that I've designed, but it's one where it can inflate my own ego. And, and so a couple of years ago, my book Leaders Open Doors came out, and I was doing some speaking, and I was in Training and Development magazine, T&D magazine, and I was on page 8. There was my picture, and it was saying that I'm Bill Treasurer speaking at a conference. He's talking at this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, hey, you know, I was home and looked at it. I was like, hey, that's me. And then I go in the book a little bit further, and on page 23, there's my picture again because I was speaking at a second conference. I'm like, hey, look at me. I'm speaking at two. I'm in this magazine twice. So I did the thing that any humble guy would do. I took the magazine upstairs to show my wife so I could brag on myself, right? I walk upstairs with my big giant ego and I look, honey, page 8, look at me. And then I go back to page 23 and I point to it. Me. You know, thinking like maybe she'll give me more applause because that's just what I need, more applause. And she didn't. She looked at me with that universal look of spousal disgust. That only your spouse can look at you with. And she said 5 words, but they were the words that I needed in that moment, and she knew it. She looked at me with that look of disgust, and she said, go clip your nose hairs. So my ego went, suddenly the air came out of the balloon, right? Like it needed to. And so I did. I went downstairs and clipped my nose hairs. But she's my chief ego deflator. She keeps me in check, right? Like like I'm sure after our podcast today, you know, there'll be garbage to be taken out and laundry to fold, and I'm just another member of the family. Sometimes I'm the lowest member of the family, right? But it's good because I need that because I get inflation of my ego in other parts of my life, and in fact. On the other hand, as much as I make fun there by chief ego deflator, she's also my chief encouragement officer. There are times where I've been down and she'll build me up. She gave me the confidence to start my own business and backed me up and supported me. And that meant, you know, economic insecurity for a while and such. So shout out to my wife. She does a great job of trying to manage this ego called Bill Treasurer.
You know, it's funny you use that example because that literally happened to me this week. I put a proposal in to speak at the SHRM Atlanta conference in March.
Nice.
And I got approved, and of course I was over the moon. You know, excited. I was like, "Oh, look, I got the money!"
Yeah.
<know? laughs> And it's like, great. It's like. Okay. and talking with my family members and such. But but they're also my biggest cheerleaders, so fully understand. So it is I do agree as a leader, you need those people.
So that would be my tip number two, right? Like have that appoint that person, have that person, value that person, cherish that person, invite that person to give you the feedback. But what you don't want to do is become insular with your own inflated ego, with no management of it, if you're not capable of managing it, and then be surrounded by yes people and sycophants. That's dangerous for leadership.
Exactly. Well, I think, you know, a lot of times, and I'm sure we all three of us have dealt with it, you know, people confuse confidence with arrogance. You know, well, I'm just confident in myself. And it's like, no, you're arrogant.
Yeah. Exactly.
I love the idea of appointing these special people. It really speaks to being purposeful about your development. And it reminds me of a term you use in the book that I love, which is be your own project. You know, like if you're going to take on the tips like you're talking about, be purposeful about them and really, you know where you're going and pull all the right levers to get there.
Yeah, a lot of times, I'm sure the two of you have experienced this as well, that a lot of times the coachees, you know, sometimes they're very technical people. A lot of times they're engineers, and the human side, they're you know, technically brilliant, and they are very proficient and competent and such. And yet the interpersonal side and the empathy side sometimes is waning a little bit. And they're like, so what do I do? And I said, well, let's talk. You know, what are you good at? And they're like, well, I'm really good at managing projects. I do a work breakdown structure. I know what the scheduling dates are. I know what the finances are that are going to take that. I know what the intervention points and the milestones. And I'm like, everything that you just said that you do there really competently, do it for yourself. You're your own project, right? Like, break this down. Let's identify the actions. Let's identify the end state. What has to happen before the other thing? When are you going to get it done by? What's the accountability points? You know, just manage yourself like a project, and you can get through these moments.
Oh, that's great. You know, I still get amazed at times, you know, still companies will put someone in a leadership role because they were technically good. And not that they can't have leadership capabilities, you know, but a lot of times those are areas that need to be developed, especially in very technical areas.
Yeah, indeed. Right. And a lot of times for those people, that butt kicking moment is of the interpersonal nature, which makes it so perplexing that they are so technically brilliant or have an engineering mindset, and they neglect the empathetic things and the interpersonal things, and that becomes the feedback. And people start leaving because they don't feel that you care about them and feel that you're obnoxious, and kind of you are because you're not an interpersonal person. And then you realize that, well, all right, I guess I got to do something about that, and I don't know how. How do I do this? And so it becomes the point of learning for a person.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we're nearing at the end of a time of our podcast here. So, Bill, is there any other big key takeaways or some things you'd like to encourage or tell our audience?
I guess that I would tell your audience that, listen, if and when this happens to you, and as I mentioned, it's an inevitable thing. You're going to have a mistake. You're going to have a failure. You're going to get tough feedback at some point. You're going to have a humiliating event and an embarrassing event. And what I would say is, welcome to the club. That's when you get to be a leader. Now you get to get ushered into the real, into the inner sanctum, the back room, the chamber of leadership. It's through this hardship, these disappointing events, that now you get to get seasoned like the other leaders that you admire. And if you come out of this on the right side, and are accepting of the lessons that it'll give you, you'll be able to have a wonderful blend of confidence and humility, which will ultimately increase your impact with people. You'll be able to have a positive impact on them and the organization. And those are the best results that you can have. Your legacy can start to be shaped when you come out of this butt kick moment. Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And it's when you get up off the mat that's when the things really start to take shape and happen. So I know that they can be startling and that they can sting, but ultimately this can actually be the best thing that'll ever happen to your leadership. In fact, Steve Jobs said that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that ever happened to him. And it was a transformative time in his own life, and much of it on a leadership level.
Absolutely. And I remember hearing that. Well, so your book, A Leadership Kick in the Ass, tell us how they can get copies of it.
Well, the beauty is that right now, if they get it before the holiday, because the holidays are coming up, yes. If they get it for the holiday, I will donate $5 from every purchase of the book. My aim is to get 1,000 people to buy 1,000 copies of the book so I can donate $5,000 to a program for kids that support kids with special needs. So that's a certain incentive. So they can get it at any of their online retailers. It's available for pre-order now. They'll have it before the holidays. And they can also go to the website, couragebuilding.com/kickass.
We won't forget that too quickly. Okay.
And maybe some employees, if you're listening to this, you could give it to your boss as a Christmas present.
There you go. Good idea.
Well, you know,
I want to share with the audience a few things that I really liked about the book, which lead me to really sincerely recommend it as a gift or for oneself. You know, we've had a good opportunity to hear about the content of the book from Bill, but I also want to tell you, this book is written really well. It was super accessible, super readable. As you have heard on today's podcast, this guy can turn a phrase and come up with great word choices that just make this thing really a pleasure to read. And I really do recommend it. I thought it was great. And I know a lot of people out there will enjoy the experience of learning about kicks in the ass, as well as, you know, benefit it by being able to avoid them or at least use them for all their work.
Well, Jenny, that makes me feel great. I'm going to have to pay a visit to my wife after hearing those flattering comments. I'm going to have to go to see the chief ego deflator. But that's super sweet. I really appreciate it. Really, that's a high compliment. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And on top of it, you continue, because I know you've done this past in helping children with special needs and such, you know, which is amazing. Not everyone does that. And you should be highly commended for that as well.
Well, I appreciate it. The second book, Leaders Open Doors, has raised over $20,000 for programs to support kids with special needs. And it's something that's near and dear to my heart. I happen to have a daughter who has cerebral palsy and she's deaf. And she brings great meaning to my life, as do my two sons. And so I appreciate your acknowledging that. And, you know, those folks especially deserve us to be good people to serve them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jenny, Bill, as always, this has been a pleasure. And Bill, we'll certainly have you on again, you know, either for maybe your next book or even to talk about what people have learned listening to your book or to reading your book, A Leadership Kick in the Ass.
Well, always fun speaking with the two of you. Thanks, Lori. And thanks, Jenny. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Great to be here.